Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to Sufi Pilgrims Progress Podcasts. Today we're going to have a very heavy-duty talk. And by heavy-duty, I mean this is something that people really need to be aware of and need to start working on, all of us. No matter what level we're at in our spiritual and character development, we all need to take cognizance of these issues. And I've seen people in very high places just lose it, and people who should know better. So, what are we talking about? Okay, today's talk is going to be entitled The Seven Deadly Sins and the Five Klisas. Okay, so don't want to name names, but the people here today need to take cognizance of it. It's okay, we won't point out anyone individually. This is not the sunnah, by the way. This is a side note. The sunnah in Islam, if you need to correct people, then you don't do it publicly because that just embarrasses them, but you take them aside and you don't do it aggressively either. You do it gently, neutrally, rationally, and you try to explain to them what you see that they're doing wrong and how they could be doing otherwise. So this is an Islamic adab that I didn't know when I was younger, but I've learned since, and it's absolutely correct. Okay, so what we're talking about today is really the most fundamental part of the path. In Arabic, we call it jihad an-nafs. Okay, the battle against the ego. Or we could also entitle it, because the five klisas are a little bit different from Buddhism, we could also entitle it avoiding falsehood. The Buddhists say that the biggest sin is ignorance, is falsehood, and there's something to be said for that. The Christians say that the most important sin is pride, and the Muslims say that the most important sin is shirk, making partners with Allah. But all of them are actually connected. They're all intimately connected. Okay, so first, the seven deadly sins. Now, I've taken this model from Christianity, not because it isn't covered in Islam. It is covered in Islam, but the Christians have a very clear and concise model that I find is very workable. You can use it. As the American politicians would say, this is an actionable model. Okay, you can make it your MO. You can use it on a daily basis, and it's not too complicated, and you don't need the four volumes of Imam Ghazali, Ihya al-Muhyiddin, to know, you know, where the bad qualities are. It's all concise. The seven deadly sins, and I refer back to it myself on a regular basis. First deadly sin, and Islam talks about this often also, pride, kibr. Okay, now, pride is a difficult one. Some of the others are more obvious, because usually people are acting in a prideful way. If you're hearing some noise in the background, that's my espresso coffee machine that I'm very proud of. Okay, it's just doing its number. Pride is a tricky one, because a lot of people who are very proud are not aware of the level of their pride. Okay, amongst other people, and we could give a lot of examples, amongst other people are doctors. I was trained as a medical doctor, and you know, many of the doctors are very proud of their accomplishment, of their status, etc. And it means that they don't listen to their patients, and they don't accept to learn from their patients. They just want to learn from other doctors, which is very unfortunate, really. So that's one consequence of pride. Now, the story I tell, and I think I can tell it safely, it's about a close relative of mine, because he'll never listen to these tapes, so I don't have to worry about that, who was an investment banker. And at some point in time, he started off as a more like a regular MBA economist working for the World Bank, and he ended up in the investment industry by a series of events. And in the end, he made lots of money, like millions of dollars. And at one point, we were talking, and he was on the front page of Barron's magazine, for those who know it, a financial magazine from the United States, very high prestige magazine. And he was kind of bragging, he was showing his pride, and he said, we said, oh, that's great, whatever your name is, that's terrific that you made it so well, we're very happy. And he said to me, I think my other brother was there at the same time, and he said to me, you don't know how good I am at this. That's why I have this page front cover of the Barron's magazine. From that moment on, he never succeeded in business once again. Never. So, and there's Islamic teachings to this effect. If you elevate yourself, Allah lowers you. And if you look at the names of Allah, I don't remember the Arabic terms, but Allah is the elevator and the lower, the one who brings you down. So be careful, because if you're too proud of your accomplishments, the next thing that could happen to you is you could lose it all. Okay. Muhammad Ali, who is really a wonderful person with a wonderful story, said at some point to someone, I know why I have this terrible illness. He was afflicted with Parkinsonism. He said it was because this is a message from Allah, because he had become a Muslim by then. And he said I was the greatest. And this is a terrible sin, because the greatest is Allah. So he saw a direct connection between his statements and the result. Most of us don't see it that clearly. So pride is a very dangerous element, and we have to be careful on all of it. Especially religious people sometimes get very proud because they say, well, everyone else is a sinner, but I'm a holy man, you know. I'm an upright man. So this can be another form of spiritual pride, which is dangerous. One of the great sheikhs, Abdul Qadir Jilani, they said he met this man in the street, or maybe it wasn't even a man, maybe it was just an apparition. And he said, oh, Sheikh Abdul Qadir Jilani, you are the greatest of the shuyukh. You are the most noble, you are the most knowledgeable. You are so high that you don't even have to do your salat anymore. And Abdul Qadir Jilani realized, radiallahu anhu, what was going on right away, and he said, "A'udhu billahi," and he realized it was the devil who had come to tempt his pride. Okay, so pride is something. Now, why is this a heavy-duty talk? Because I want people to do muraqabah. Muraqabah means be self-aware, and the Buddhists call this noting. Just note when you're in a prideful moment. It's actually the hardest of the seven ones, I think, to identify. Sometimes you need people around you to point it out to you. It's not easy to identify pride, because it comes up instinctively, naturally, and in some situations, it's okay if you just studied for 4 years and you got your degree and you got it summum cum magne or magne cum laude or whatever, and you're feeling really good about it, you know, it's probably not exaggerate, but if you go exaggerated, but if you go around saying, and I'm the smartest student in this class, you know, Allah's going to end up lowering you. So be careful. Okay, so pride. We'll have to do more talking about it. It's not an easy one, because we have examples where people have to assert their authority, and it might sound like pride. Like, there were times where our Prophet, for example, said, he is the best who treats his family best, and I'm the one who treats my family the best of all of you. So someone could say, hey, he's being proud here, this is pride, but actually this is just a statement of fact and a teaching for people. So then they could watch how he was with his family, and from there they could see the proper way to be. So sometimes we do have to assert our authority. Like if someone tells me, I had one foolish murid once consulting me about his wife, and I told him what the diagnosis was and what we had, and he started arguing with me about the diagnosis. I've been practicing psychiatry for 30 years. He had read some book or read some passages in the DSM and was starting to argue with me about what his wife was suffering from. And I was quiet at the time, but I could have easily said, you know, look, I've been doing this work for 35 years, and I have a lot of clinical experience. I think I know what I'm talking about, please. And that wouldn't have been pride. It would have been just putting the other person in their proper place. So there's a place for it. Okay, we won't stay too long because we could do, and we may eventually do that, we could do a whole talk on each of these. Number two, anger. This is one that people get into trouble with a lot. Okay, anger. And so, again, remember the Buddhist practice of noting. If you're getting angry, note it. If you can just note it right away, tell yourself, I'm angry, that is already a huge step. Because what people do when they get angry is they get, as they say in French, pompé. They get all pumped up, and then they say things that they regret for the rest of their life, or do things, or throw things, or insult people, or all this kind of... This is not, of course, the Sufi way. We have to learn to control our anger. You know, and it can get perverse at times. There's a teacher, I won't name him here, but there's a teacher who was telling his Muslim students about... the hadith of the Prophet, peace be upon him, that says, La taqdab, don't get angry. To one man, most Muslims know this. And he was, so what he was doing, and this fellow had a lot of knowledge about Arabic and grammar and everything, and he was saying, it didn't mean don't get angry. But of course it meant don't get angry. This was just, he was a person who got angry from time to time. And so he was defending himself from this anger by saying, no, this doesn't mean what it appears to mean. You see how our nafs can get quite perverse, and when it has a lot of knowledge, it can get even more perverse. So we have to be careful. But most of us are not at that level of denial, but when we get angry, we'll justify it. Well, this person did this and that and this and that and that, so I have every right to be angry. Okay. You have a right to be angry, but then you have to ask the question, do you have a right to express your anger, or how are you going to express your anger? Our Prophet ﷺ was known to, at times when he would get angry, all his companions would see was that his face was getting red. That's all they saw. He didn't shout, he didn't, astaghfirullah, he didn't swear, he didn't say nasty things. All that happened was face got red, and then whatever had to be said was said in a calm, assertive way. The psychologists say, change anger to assertiveness. It's a good principle. So don't be angry, and you can't say don't be angry, but don't express the anger. Okay. Especially not immediately. Hold on to it, contain it, and see what the appropriate means of expression is. It may be better to wait till after the situation has passed through before expressing it. And then the next day, for example, if it's in a couple situation, the next day you say, you know, honey, last night I came home and I was really tired, and then you were insisting that I do the dishes. Someone here understands this issue very well. You were insisting that I do the dishes, and I was just so tired. I thought it was almost cruel to ask me to do the dishes. But you don't come in and then start swearing at you, you know, whatever people do when they get angry. And this is a big problem in a lot of areas, in a lot of countries in the Muslim world also. People just get angry and they just explode. And it's not good. So anger is a big one. When you get angry, try to catch yourself. It's hard. You have to catch yourself very quickly. In English, we say, nip it in the bud. Catch it really quickly before you let it get out of control. Number three is envy. And each of these subjects, as I say, is an ocean. And Sheikh Hamza Yusuf was saying that this is one that people never admit. They'll admit the worst parts of their behavior. He said, like criminals, they'll admit they murdered or stole or assaulted people, but they'll never admit that they're envious. You know, it's something that people are either not aware of or they don't want to acknowledge. So It's another tricky one, a bit like pride, and there are places in the English language and literature, pride and envy are put together. So they can work together, actually, but it's a little trickier to catch that one. But if you see yourself being envious and you catch yourself, the treatment is easy, actually. So let's say, and the Bible, the Ten Commandments say, don't envy your neighbor for their wife or their cattle or whatever else, or their property. Don't be envious, you know, but the tendency is there. So what's the treatment? The treatment is actually simple for envy, but you have to catch yourself first. The treatment is to say, this is what Allah ordained for him, and this is what Allah ordained for me. So if his wife is prettier than your wife, or his child got into medical school, God forbid, and your child didn't, you know, you don't have to be envious, because each thing has been ordained. Allah has ordained what you need for you. What's best, not only what you need, what's best for you, Allah has given you. And this was best for the other, Allah's. And there's no need for comparison, whatever. So we have to catch ourselves again with envy. Sloth. Now, laziness. Now, in the Islamic practice, we have a kind of barometer here. Anyone have an idea what the barometer is? Now, we have a clear-cut measure that can help us fight against sloth. It's not complete.
The prayer.
The Fajr prayer, you have to get up in the middle of the night, just before dawn, to do the Fajr prayer. That is a test of your laziness, and that is a treatment for your laziness. By not, because as soon as you get up, I guarantee you, unless you're very far advanced, as soon as you get up, your nafs, your ego is going to say, oh, I'm still tired, can I just reset the alarm clock, and then you forget to put it on? Can't I just have 10 minutes more of sleep, and you wake up 3 hours later? You know, there are 100 different, the ego immediately objects to when you get up for Fajr prayer, unless you're in a particular hal or in a particular situation, and there also it may be just, well, all the other guys around, if they see me sleeping through Fajr, they're going to think I'm a slacker Muslim, so I better get up. Okay, that's a form of motivation in a way, but possibly not the best. But then as soon as you're back alone, you're going to sleep through it again. So we have a good treatment. It's not a complete treatment, because there are people who get up for Fajr regularly, and then they're slothful during the day. So another form of sloth is procrastination. What you're supposed to do right now, oh, I have a homework assignment, it's due tomorrow, I'll get started later tonight, or maybe I'll get up early in the morning and do it just before. And this is also a tendency of the ego, procrastination. And that is another form of sloth. So sloth is a problem. Sheikh Nazim used to say that the ideal for the ego would be that he's lying under a tree and that the fruit or the grapes are falling right into his mouth. That's the ego ideal. You know, no work involved, no cooking, no planting, no harvesting, just the food falls right in your mouth. Okay. So, and there are children who are raised that way. Well, there's a good expression in French about that. Something dans le bec.
C'est tout cuit dans le bec.
Tout cuit dans le bec. Their food is already like the young birds. Their food is already mashed up and cooked and ready to be digested and put right in their mouth by the mothers. And some mothers, unfortunately, are like that, so the children, it takes them a long time to learn to become independent because they were too spoiled when they were young. So that's sloth, again, a huge subject. And again, note it. When you feel like you're being sloth, just call it what, before you even decide to do anything, just call it what, call yourself out. There's a good American expression. Call yourself out. This is sloth. Okay. It's 1:30, the Dhuhr time, it's time for noon salat. Asr isn't till 5:30. I'll take my time, I'll go for a walk, I'll have a snack, you know. All of that is procrastination. It's also, it can be slothful. I was just, some of the Maghribian countries, they put, at when it's very long between the two, they put the dhuhr later, closer to the asr. It's reasonable, a kind of option, so that people can work for a while, and then they'll do the two prayers in succession, provided you still respect the time sequences. So, you know, we don't want to get into excessive finger pointing, but beware, it's a biggie. Greed, number five. Now, greed is possibly, greed and the next one, lust, are the two greatest examples of deadly sins in the modern world. In fact, greed has become, in the modern world, greed has become a science. In fact, we have all kinds of sciences of greed. The sciences of business administration are actually, if you break them down, they're the science of greed. The science of international trade arrangements is the science of greed. The science of so many things, and we have financial planning, and we have all these administrators and executives trying to organize things so that the executive ends up, chief executive ends up making, you know, $10 million a year, and the person working underneath him at the bottom of the ladder is getting minimum wage, which can be as low as $6 in America an hour, and the president is getting $5 million, $10 million, $20 million in bonuses. This is greed, but it's not, it's systematized greed. It's scientifically generated greed, and we have a lot of that. So we have countries claiming that they're such generous countries because they give 1% of their GDP in charity. Oh, we're so generous. Like my beloved Canada, we're so good to Syrian refugees. We're taking 25,000. Yeah, but there are 4 million of them. Jordan is taking 1.5 million. Turkey is taking 2 million. Lebanon is taking 1 million. All of those countries are much smaller, much less wealthy. So, you know, get a grip on it, Canada. You're not that generous. And many of these refugees are having to be sponsored by Canadians, so the government pays even less. Okay. So, and when the countries come out and say, when not only Trump, any leader says, I'm going to do what's best for my economy, for my nation's economy, that's greed. When someone says, I'm going to plan everything completely so I have the maximum amount of money in my retirement fund, that's greed. So many forms of greed. When someone is saving all their money to buy properties one after the other and not taking proper care of their wives, their children, the people around them, that's greed. So we've made it into a systematic process in our society. And we have all kinds of trades, including economists and business administration and trade negotiators and all these people who are practicing greed on an official level. Okay. Let's get into some stuff. I was going to say, let's get into one that's close to my heart. Lust. Okay. I'm half joking here, but... lust is also something that our current society encourages. Instead of discouraging, like the Quran, that tells us to be modest, to keep our gaze down, the modern society encourages the opposite. Okay. The most flagrant example in the Western countries is how, and the feminists are going to get on my case for this, but how the women dress during the summer, exposing as much as they can of their wares to provoke male lust, and which comes back to them as a form of narcissism, if you want. Oh, look how hot that chick is, you know, and then she's saying, oh, these guys, but she's feeling great about the fact that people are checking her out. The whole concept of checking out is haram in our way. We're not supposed to be checking out, either ladies or men. In the old days, it used to be all about ladies, you know. The men were into, you know, boobs and butts. That's what it was all about, you know, Playboy magazine. And, you know, that's what the men talked about in the bar. And now we've gotten so much more advanced. Now the ladies have the same thing, because the ladies are now looking for six-pack and biceps and well-defined chest muscles and all of this kind of thing. So the ladies have been encouraged to be as foolish as the men, you know, in this level. This is all lust. This is all encouragement of lust. And then we're surprised relationships aren't working and people are having their hearts broken and people are being rejected left, right, and center. And all the content, marriages are breaking up, and infidelity, and adultery, and all of these things. And the society continues, whatever, through its fashion industry of various sorts, to generate more and more lust. And if you say something about it, you're already some kind of male chauvinist or whatever. And no one's saying anything about the other side either, in any case, about the women who are now being looking for the same kind, with the same kind of lustful glances that the men were in previous epochs. And that's not even on the horizon right now. So this is a society that generates lust left, right, and center, and all of its consequences, including, paradoxically, impotence in males. Big, huge subject now. You see all the Viagra and Cialis and now all these supplements for increasing testosterone, impotence, which was, I wouldn't say wasn't on the horizon, but it was much less of a problem because people are indulging them sexually to the extent where nothing excites them anymore. And pornography, of course. I mustn't forget pornography. How many cases did I see of that in my psychiatric practice? People being encouraged to see things that they're not supposed to see. And then after a while, they lose their attraction for their partner. They've seen all these other bodies and all these other sexual situations, and they've lost any desire for the partner that they're supposed to be doing this with. So this is all going on. And then, last but not least, gluttony. Encouraging gluttony in French is gourmandise. One year, I was in New York during Ramadan. I hadn't been aware of this before, but I was in New York City visiting my brother in Ramadan. I couldn't believe how much advertisement there was everywhere about food. Okay. Not only McDonald's and donut shops and delicatessens and Harvey's and whatever else. We have Tim Hortons, that's the one I was looking for. But everywhere were advertisements for food. Now, if you go into a typical restaurant in America, and people wonder about the obesity, if you go into a typical restaurant, I'm not even talking about the cheapo restaurants like McDonald's and Wendy's, the portions that they give you are probably more than twice what you really need for your caloric intake. I read that in a diet book. It was very clever. She says, never eat more than half of what they serve you in a restaurant. It's hyper, there's too many calories in. And then you have the all-you-can-eat counter. You know, like now, some people like to go even all-you-can-eat sushi. But before you had all-you-can-eat, you know, salads and everything, and people pouring on plates and plates. Sheikh Nu used to talk about the third serving of lasagna. I don't know why. I guess he has something for lasagna. Or that third serving of lasagna that you absolutely don't need. One is usually more than enough. So gluttony, and then we have to catch ourselves. This is a problem, you know, for many of us have some level of weight problem because we don't know where to stop. And there's actually something inside of us that tells us, but we've overrid the signal so many times that we keep overriding it. So there's a whole place for consciousness in here. Okay, in each of these sinful areas, if we just note it, we can at least get humble about how many defects we still have in ourselves, and we can begin to start struggling against it. Now, I didn't want to leave this subject without mentioning the other model, which I think is useful also. But this is more of a model of things that are problematic on the spiritual path than actual sin. And it's the Buddhist model of the five klesas. According to the Buddhist, the five obstacles to enlightenment, to spiritual development, are desire, aversion, laziness, agitation, and doubt. Okay. Now, desire already overlaps. Okay, so we've seen that in the Christian model, lust, greed, gluttony, maybe envy. All of these are forms of desire. So there's an overlap, nothing new. Aversion includes the anger, but also includes the fear. So we're going to have to also note the fear state when we get anxious for no reason or even for a reason. Okay, now here we're going to change from noting to mindfulness. So if you get into an anxious state, learn how to be mindful of that state of aversion, which is fear and anxiety. Okay, so you have to look at the thoughts, the emotions, the physical sensations connected with it. That's a whole other subject. But in the Buddhist klesas, we're going to practice mindfulness. Just become aware of them. Laziness is also an overlap. Agitation. Agitation is a big one, as we know. A lot of people just, they can't stop. And they're just in overdrive all the time. Anxious, agitated, hyperactive, and this is a disease of the modern times also. And that also requires mindfulness. So if you find yourself in an agitated state, try to stop and just become mindful of your breath. It might help you slow down a bit. Although some will justify it and say, oh, if I'm not active all the time, I'm just going to be more anxious or I'm going to get depressed. No. You've got to look at it squarely in the face, as they say, and see that this agitation is not healthy. Okay. Doubt. Now, doubt is on many levels encouraged in our society. It was the Christians knew it was a problem, and the Muslims know it's a problem in some areas, but it's also encouraged, like the scientific model is all based on the null hypothesis. And the null hypothesis is based on doubt. The scientific model is also based on the possibility that you can disprove the hypothesis. So you have to doubt everything that comes to you, you have to doubt. Now there is a place for doubt, but doubt can also become problematic and even sinful, as the Quran says about dhan, that too much of it can even become a sin. So we have to watch our doubting mind. If you see yourself in that state, go back to mindfulness. Okay. So this is a huge project, what I'm talking about today. And I hope people will try to think about it and see how they can use this information to improve themselves. This is the jihad anafs. This is the tazkiya, the purification process, is dealing with the seven deadly sins and the five klesas. May Allah help us in this difficult and subtle battle against our own egos. Subhana rabbika rabbil izzati amma yasifun. Wassalamu ala mursalin wa hamdulillahi rabbil alamin.